Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
You are now entering the Bolt Zone.
Welcome to the Bolt Zone. This is a competitive Magic podcast for the average spike, co-hosted by me, Cody DuBose, and former PT champion and Magic World champion, Nathan Stoyer. We're bringing you the best tips, tricks, and strategies to improve your game and be a better player. Nathan is back from PT Chicago today, so we have a lot to talk about, including a look behind the curtain at Nathan's World Champion card, Duelist of the Mind, and everything that went down at the MKM Pro Tour. But before we dive in, Nathan, how are you doing today?
I'm doing great. I think that I've been so fully invested in Pioneer and, you know, playing the Chicago PT and testing with my folks at Team Handshake that I almost didn't really get a chance to take in my World Championship card, Duelist of the Mind, until the day it was spoiled. You know, I sort of knew that I was going to be broadcasting it on stream, but prior to that, I was just like sort of out of my head and somewhere else. And now that it's finally here, I'm so excited that I get to share it with the world and talk about some of the processes that led to its development.
Yeah, super exciting. I'm really excited to talk about it today and sort of hear more about that process, because that's a very unique thing. But during the PTI, I like had turned on Twitch at one point, and it was right as you were starting to like talk about the card, and you were like sitting at the news deck, and I was like, hang on, what's going on right now?
Yeah, I definitely was a little nervous, I'm not gonna lie. I've done like interviews before, but the setup was a little bit different than like, okay, I'm getting interviewed by someone. It's like I'm in the booth, I'm talking with Cedric and Maria, and I'm sort of just, you know, saying what comes to my head to describe it. I didn't really have a planned out idea of what I was going to say, to be quite honest. They were just like, okay, like, here's a question for you. And I'm trying to keep myself together. And so I don't think I came across badly, but I was certainly nervous. And I felt like the actual final product is something that I'm super proud of. And yeah, I'm looking forward to just talking about, you know, how did I get here and where do we see this maybe being an option in constructive formats going forward?
Well, we'll dive into that in just a minute. But before we do, we have some shout outs. We want to thank everyone who takes the time to listen and support the show. We appreciate all the support as always. And this week, we need to give a special big shout out to Andrew Z for becoming the latest patron of the Bolt Zone. Thank you, Andrew, for your support. And if you want to support the show, you can also join the Patreon. We'll put the link for that down in the show notes. Or you can head over to our new merch shop at boltthebirdmtg.com/shop. We have a big selection of hats, t-shirts, hoodies, sweatshirts, everything you can think of, pins for your bag. So if you want some merch to help support the show, head on over there. Let us know on Twitter if you buy anything. Use the hashtag BoltZoneChat. You can get in touch with us over there. Show us how you're repping the merch out in the wild, because we'd love to see that. And we also have some big news today. We are thrilled to let you know that the show is now sponsored by TOA Magic. Now, if you've been to any Magic conventions, you're probably familiar with TOA already. It's really hard to miss their purple and gold banners and the huge selection that they have. They got over 77,000 unique products in stock, including 80 plus pieces of Power 9, every revised duel, and 99% of standard cards. So next time you're looking to pick up singles, you need to look no further than TOA. And to sweeten the deal, they are offering free tracked shipping on every order. So that's something you're not going to have to worry about. You just pay for the cards, don't have to worry about shipping. You're going to know when they show up. And then you can also choose to pick up your order at the convention center if you're heading out to a big event and need some last minute pickups. Which, speaking of, TOA is going to be at SCGCon Philly this weekend, as well as SCGCon Atlanta, Command Fest LA, and Command Fest Dallas in April. So be on the lookout for their booth there if you need to pick up some sweet singles. I personally had a great experience working with TOA for the Denver RC that I just want to shout out. I had an order for my RC deck from another vendor hit a snag somewhere in the shipping process and get delayed. And it was about a week out and I couldn't find the cards I needed anywhere else. So I fired up an order over at TOA, got everything I needed, picked it up the morning of the event with no friction. It was the most stress-free experience you can imagine. So I can't recommend them highly enough based on their card selection and service for your next order. But if for you top-tier service isn't enough, you can also get 5% off everything. Yes, that includes sealed products, duals, power, and every single you can imagine using the code BOLTZONE at checkout. So head on over to toamagic.com and experience the difference for yourself. Again, toamagic.com and use code BOLTZONE at checkout for 5% off your entire order. All right. Thanks again to TOA for sponsoring the show. But Nathan, I think it's time to dive into your world championship card, Duelist of the Mind, which we've seen affectionately referred to as Ledger Stoyer.
Appreciate whoever came up with that nickname. I found that pretty humorous when I saw it on Twitter for the first time, but let's just get into what Duelist of the Mind does. So for those unfamiliar, one cool thing about Duelist of the Mind is it is the only world championship card with a star power. So meaning its power is equal to the number of cards you've drawn this turn. And its base power is, of course, zero, except if you're playing it on your turn, its power is usually one because you've drawn a card for turn. The card costs one and a blue, similar to Yuji Takahashi's Fairy Mastermind from last year. We see that pretty popular mana cost that I chose with the idea of, well, what do I want access to people for those who want to play it in Constructed, and what sort of embodies the things about Magic that I like? And when I thought about this question and the associated mana cost, what came to mind for me was I really want something that I can play in either a tempo style blue deck or something that I can play in Vintage Cube, one of my favorite formats to play. And it just so happens that one in a blue is the easiest mana cost to achieve when your goal is to make it playable in these formats. And so the other cool thing about Duelist of the Mind is it is a flying and vigilance creature. So star power, flying, vigilance, and three toughness. And the mechanic introduced in this set, which I spoiled on the Wizards of the Coast live stream on Sunday at the PT, is crime. So we're down in, we're at Thunder's, at Outlaws of Thunder Junction. And one of the cool mechanics in this set is committing crimes, which means, for those unfamiliar, committing a crime means you target anything of the opponent's. It's actually quite simple for a complex mechanic. It's just the basic idea of when you target any of the opponent's stuff, so you target them, a card of theirs on the stack, a card of theirs in the graveyard, or a creature of theirs, you get a trigger, which is committing a crime. And in this case, the reward for committing a crime is when you commit a crime, you get to loot. So you get to draw a card and discard a card, and you can only do that once per turn. So some mechanics like crime may have upsides when you commit a crime, or you might have a card that says when your opponent commits a crime, they have a downside happen. But the flexibility of the mechanic means that there's a lot of space for you to figure out what are other cards that incentivize committing crimes and might work well with this, and what are cards that also reward you for taking advantage of the loot. One thing that I'm thinking about with Duelist of the Mind is, what are the most powerful interactions in Standard, given the fact that in the next month or so, there's going to be Pro Tour Thunder Junction in Seattle? And so the immediate ones that came to mind are, well, what happens when you combine Duelist of the Mind with Rafine? Rafine, obviously one of the most powerful cards in Standard and leads to the Esper Midrange Shell that's been popular for the last year and a half or so. What it does with Rafine is you get to make it extremely huge really quickly, because not only does it get big for every single card that you draw, it also gets counters for every single spell that you discard, and so it sort of plays double duty. And in a format where you have a lot of cutdowns running around, and you also have a lot of cards like Denik, which take advantage of being looted away and put in the graveyard in their traditional Esper shell, it's pretty easy to imagine that if you curve Duelist of the Mind into Rafine, you are very quickly going to make it a threat that kills your opponent as quick as turn 4 or 5, really.
So yeah, that curve is so smooth too.
Exactly. And there are a lot of competing cards in the 2-drop slot, but the other cool interaction I like, which is pretty basic but works pretty well, is when you combine Duelist of the Mind with Deep Cavern Bat, you also get a loot trigger, meaning that these two cards in your two drop slot of a blue black deck synergize immediately. And the other thing that it does well is combine with Inti, a card that we've seen a lot in Modern, and we've seen in, or rather in Pioneer, and we've seen it in Standard and in various shells at this point. But what I like about it with Inti is you get to abuse the fact that every single time you discard, you get to trigger Inti's ability. And so you're actually getting card advantage from it. And if you curve Duelist of the Mind into Inti, you very quickly are going to just get to get through your deck really quickly. It helps that you can leverage cheap counter magic or other disruption in order to trigger Inti as well. So looking forward to those two specific cards as my cards to watch as we get into the next Standard format.
Yeah, that's really sweet. I one of the things I missed, I guess, originally was that you can commit a crime targeting something on the stack. I didn't realize that that also worked. I thought it was just permanence in the player. So that there's just so many ways to do it. It's not hard to see you doing this consistently, like on your turn and their turn every time.
Right. I mean, it plays really well with No More Lives, and it just is going to loot on basically anything you play that interacts with the opponent. And so it does place a higher onus on having relevant cards in the graveyard. That's kind of the hardest metric to achieve, right? It's like, if you're playing a format like Standard, it's hard to make a ton of cards that matter in the graveyard. And if you can do so, that's when the card becomes actually abusable. As a card by itself, though, I'm curious to see if it actually will show up in these tier one decks. I mean, as much as I would like that to be the case, I'm currently feeling like they really have to have some rewards for the crime theme or otherwise place some new enablers into the format.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to kind of see what comes in surrounding it. But let's talk about the design process, unless you have any other thoughts on like the actual design of the card itself. But like, take us through like that timeline. I know, like, obviously your world championship win was quite a while ago at this point. What was the process like behind this?
So the play design team, consisting of Andrew Brown and several other members at Wizards of the Coast, reached out to me shortly following my world championship win in 2022. And one cool thing about the process is they're very open to feedback in terms of what sort of direction do I want to take it in and how can they help facilitate like an entirely new design that meets what I like about Magic. And so what we went through is a series of questions like, one, what sort of cards do you want your card to be built around? And I suggested, I want my card to feel... Initially, I was like, I want my card to produce treasures. I was like, I want a cheap card that produces treasures. And
Goldspan,
let
Nathan.
Me tell you, that was the quickest thing that they shot down. They were immediately like, no, we can't do that. And they were like, there's no treasures on this plane. And I'm like, what? There's like cowboys and other things and you can't do treasures? And they were like, nope, sorry, no treasures. So that was a little bit disappointing, but I understand that treasures are a little too strong. And then I was like, I want my card to feel like Fable of the Mirrorbreaker. I want it to incorporate loots. And I also want my card to have some aspects of my winning deck. And so, you know, Corpse Appraiser is really focused on the graveyard and putting creatures in there. And also, my favorite thing to do in Magic is just draw cards. I sort of said, I want my card to allow me to draw a lot of cards and dig deeper. And so that was my initial pitch. I talked about, I want my card to loot. I want my card to draw cards. Like, I want my card to have a draw cards matters theme. So like, if you draw a card, like you get some reward for doing so. And what they do is they give you like 5 or 6 options of cards that are their initial, like, okay, here are some cards that may be in line with what you're looking for. And they'll kind of tell you like, okay, we're not going to have a final version of these cards to pitch you right now, but we're just going to give you some ideas of like where we can start. And so they pitched me 5 designs and I picked the design for this card of basically around the beginning of 2023. So a while ago.
Yeah.
And what happened after I picked the card is they spent a lot of time iterating on it and changing different versions. And so I do believe I could talk about some of the previous versions of the card. One version that was existing at some point had an ability on top of what it currently has, which is whenever you discarded a card, it got +1/+1 as well. So that version of the card was, as you can imagine, way too powerful, getting double duty of when you draw a card, you get pumped, and when you discard a card, you also get pumped.
Yeah.
The other big ability that it previously had was it wasn't limited to once a turn looting, I believe, at some point, and they very quickly decided that that was too abusable just because it was too easy to repeatedly trigger the crime ability. I mean, even if it's not a problem in standard, if you Mishra's Bobble your opponent and Grape Shot your opponent and use Underworld Breach, it's really easy to imagine how it'll kill your opponent like instantly.
Oh yeah, we can't be having too much fun.
And so those were some of the other versions, but I think one of the bigger things is just they had to nerf the card just a little bit from where it was previously at because they found it to be too strong. And I think this is one of the most challenging things in terms of game design, which is like, how do you make sure a card is meeting their goal of playable in standard and other constructed formats as they like to do for the World Championship cards while not being too powerful? Because it would be a pretty big disaster if they printed a World Championship card that they had to ban at some point. They really don't want to do that.
Right. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. So was it always slated to be in Outlaws of Thunder Junction then? Or was that a decision that came based on just the timeline of things?
I didn't really have any input in that regard, to be honest. They didn't give me much information about when it was going to be released other than a general timeline of around, you know, the first quarter of 2024. And once I got that info, I was just like, okay, it'll be out in a while. And we went back and forth on some details. I think one challenging thing about being on the other end of designing this card is it was something that I wanted to have more, you know, input on, like, where does the card's final product? And as it got changed, like a few things got added, like Vigilance and another ability got taken away. But it would be helpful or at least interesting for me to know what were the intermediate versions at all points, just so I can sort of see, because behind the scenes, they were playtesting this card significantly more than they would like an average standard card, just because they place a high emphasis on making these World Championship cards playable and fun and standard. So curious to hear at some point what their process looked like. But from my end, it was super fun to observe and just ask questions. And I think my involvement was like a very cool part of it being a card I helped design.
Yeah, that's really awesome. Like I said earlier, such a unique experience. So few people get to experience and see like the inner workings of this, you know, card design and the process that goes into it. And like, you know, you said so many different iterations and changing different aspects to sort of tune it is really cool. What about the art? Did you have any input into the art direction at all? Or
I had pretty minimal input into the art direction. They asked for some headshots and photos, and I sent them some photos so the artist could take some examples to work on. And they used some examples from my World Championship win. But what they changed about the art was originally I had like a cowboy hat and I was like a lot differently dressed than I am. And then they added wings to the photo as well. So some cool things that they added, but I'm pretty happy with what they did. I think if I could add one critique of the photo, I think that the glasses shape is something that I would personally have changed for my face, given that I have like more square glasses than their sort of circular glasses. But hard to say if that's, you know, something they could have easily changed or just what the artist went with based on what they had available.
Yeah, sure. All right. Last question about this. What about any Easter eggs that you can share? Or like any, you mentioned callbacks to like your deck that you won the World Championship with. Any little hidden gems?
I feel like I kind of talked about all the small different things about the card, except like when I was helping to design it, they initially had it as whenever a card is put into your hand instead of whenever you draw a card, its power gets buffed. And they wouldn't even tell me how, but somehow that created a broken interaction that like they couldn't do. And so I found that trying to unravel why is putting a card in hand so much more broken than drawing a card to be an interesting question. So kind of a funny thing that they changed at some point in the process, but
interesting. Yeah,
no memory deluge triggering it anymore.
Very cool. Very cool. Well, I think that was a really neat insight into this card, and I'm looking forward to playing with it and trying some things out when it comes out. And that is going to be Thunder Junction next month, right?
Yep.
Nice. Very cool. Well, with that, let's talk about the Pro Tour itself. So Murders at Karlov Manor. Tell us about your experience. Let's start with Limited and sort of break down the two draft rounds.
So I played the first draft. I sat down, and the only other player I really recognized at my table was Logan Nettles, aka Jabberwocky, for those familiar with him. And the draft went very smoothly. I started the draft by picking 5 or 6 green cards, and then seeing no other green cards for the rest of the draft, really. So I had to pivot pretty quickly, and what happened in my draft is I didn't see any more green cards, but on my pack 2, I got passed a lot of copies of various blue-black rares, and so I picked up a Lotsav and an Atrada and a Homicide Investigator and then some late removal, and ended up in one of my favorite archetypes that our team had figured out, which is just blue-black sort of control mid-range pile that has a lot of card advantage like Deduce. And so ultimately, I was really happy with how the draft went. Draft games were super close. I won the first 2 rounds, was really happy with how my deck was performing. And one interesting snippet from the draft was I first picked and second picked a Gravestone Strider, the 1/3 mannequin in pack 3. And that was one of the glue pieces for my deck that really helped it come together. And so in the round 3, I'm on feature against Jabberwocky or Logan Nettles. And I was not expecting what his deck ended up being. He had an Ezreum and he had a Cryptic Coat, 2 of the best rares in the set, in his blue-white deck. And meanwhile, I'm trying to figure out how I could possibly win against his Ezreum. He plays an insanely great game 1 where he doesn't block my creatures that I'm chump attacking in order to get my Extract the Confession or my Edict that can make him sack the most expensive creature to sack his Ezreum. And that really rewards him, so he doesn't end up ever having it die, and he kills me with it. Game 2, I steal this crazy game where he has 7 cards to my 0 cards and an active Cryptic Coat because he makes 1 or 2 turns of missteps with his attacks, getting a little too aggressive in a spot where I think he should just play defense, and he dies to a kind of lucky combination off the top. And then game 3, you could check this game out on Coverage. This was top 3 games for me in the tournament in terms of highlights, but I make a really wonky attack at some point in the middle of the game where I attack with my 3/4 Basilica Stalker and trade 3 damage for 6 damage in a weird spot, just recognizing that if the game goes too long, I'm going to die to his Cryptic Coat and Ezreum being bombs, and I can't win this type of game against him. And later down the line, I end up in a really close spot where I essentially get him down to 4 life with me having 2 3/3 flyers in play and a blocker, and him needing to draw a removal spell with no cards in hand to win in this really tight race. And ultimately, he just flips the top card of his deck on camera, hits a removal spell, and I die. And this was a 90-minute match or so. And when it was done, my whole lunch break for the day was gone. So it was just one of those matches of like, oh man, this is like, could have been the 3-0, perfect start to the day. And instead, 2-1, didn't get any food. I'm exhausted. This is just super grindy. And so that was, you know, bittersweet, but a really ultimately like fun memory from the event.
Yeah, that sounds like a really cool game. You mentioned that like in testing, your team had identified that the blue-black archetype was strong. What other thoughts do you have on like the testing that went into it? I know you've mentioned that like you spent a lot more time for this Pro Tour testing Limited than Constructed.
One big thing we recognized is that the white checks were pretty overdrafted and contested. And we did think white was the strongest power or color on power level rather. But the issue with the white decks is you would get the first few picks of white, but there was some high variance in terms of your seating at the table. So if you had a bad seat and you tried to draft the white deck and you got cut on it, your deck could become pretty bad pretty quickly. And so we were trying to avoid drafting white if we didn't have the right seat for it. And we thought, in contrast to what other teams or people thought, that black was actually a pretty good support color and drafting the black removal, especially Slice from Shadows, Extract to Confession, and Murder were all good incentives to just have black be your support color. We also thought blue was the best color in draft, which was maybe contrary to what other teams had thought. Although it doesn't have like a sheer power level in terms of commons that white has, the blue cards like Surveillance Monitor and some of the blue rares, as well as just like the uncommons in blue and red and blue and green, were all big incentives for us to want to draft blue as a color that can flash. And overall, I feel like my understanding of the limited set was very good. It didn't really reflect in how my matches went, but I would say I was very comfortable drafting the set and probably the most confident I've been in an Pro Tour draft environment.
That's good. Yeah. I mean, it's nice to hear that like the work paid off, even if the variance and the results didn't show it. But the set to me, I haven't played a ton of MKM draft, but like what you just mentioned about the white decks being maybe arguably the best, but so contested that it's hard to get like a good deck out of it without getting a little bit lucky. That's interesting. It kind of sounds like stuff we saw around like Kaldheim and Strixhaven, where there was like one archetype that was clearly better and just everyone gravitated towards it then.
The hard part when you end up in limited environments like that is sometimes you are in the seat where you should be the person getting all the cards and cutting, and that's going to work out. And in my second draft, it was very close to that case, unclear really even at the end of it if that was true, but I felt that I got, you know, squeezed in the draft seat. And this is like one of the harder things about when you have a color that people prefer so much over another, which is when you get squeezed out of a color, you can tank your whole draft really easily. And so I think that drafting a safer way, especially when you're comfortable drafting like the most underdrafted colors in blue and black, can make a huge difference.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, you're getting past stuff that no one wants, and just all of a sudden you put together this deck that's really strong because you're getting all the best cards out of those colors.
Exactly.
How about day two? Unfortunately, that one didn't go quite as well as the first day.
Rough draft. I was seated directly to the right of Jean-Emmanuel Duprat. And during the draft, you know, this doesn't actually mean anything and shouldn't really be something I derive a ton of information from, but I opened my first pack and I noticed that one of the cards is like slightly crimped at the bottom. After thinking about it, I don't think that it was like anything other than just like a foil card. But when I opened the pack, I was like, oh, this is probably a foil card. And they asked if anyone had, you know, issues with their packs. And I was like, okay, look, I'll get a replacement pack and just have like one of the worst packs I've seen in the format. I first pick something over like a white common. I don't even remember what my first pick was. And immediately I end up in this spot where I can take like another green card or a white card that I didn't think was nearly as good. Ultimately, what ended up happening in the draft was I take green and red, and those were sort of the only two colors that were open, and then feed JED on my left this perfect blue-white deck, passing him like a pack 3 Ezreal, like pick 5 or something, when I needed an uncommon for my deck. And unfortunately, I could have been the blue-white drafter with the perfect blue-white detectives deck, but instead I got smushed by him on that deck. And so really poor showing for how the draft went. And I ultimately 0-3'd for the first time in my Pro Tour draft career. So really rough draft.
Yeah, it happens. At least you got that one out of the way. Now you can move on, not have that hanging over your head. How did it feel to not be the featured drafter this time? We talked about that before, where like there were a couple events close together where featured draft, you were on camera, and you talked about how that added some nerves to the event that was just like extra on top of what it already brought to the table. How was it this time being able to, you know, play an event, not have that extra pressure?
I felt like I wasn't even really too focused on it, to be honest. Like, one thing about the featured drafter is often you'll either be featured drafted if you just won a big event like JED won Worlds and they featured him at this PT, or if you're in an extremely stacked pod and you're like one of the highlighted players. And it's kind of a good upside of knowing, okay, if you're not going to be featured, that also means that your pod might not be extremely stacked or anything.
Right.
Honestly, this would have been one of the formats where I would say, okay, if feature me in, I'll perform well and I'm like feeling comfortable. But yeah, I think that it was just good to be able to focus on the actual matches, especially when, you know, for me, it was an environment where I think every draft pick like matters a ton in terms of figuring out your direction. And then once you're in your direction, like you're kind of just settled into taking the best card of those colors, but finding that direction is important. And if you mess it up, your draft deck is going to be wildly different. So
sure.
Sort of how I perceived the format at least.
Yeah, that's interesting. Any other thoughts on Limited from the Pro Tour before we move on?
I will say, I talked about in an interview with Riley Knight how I was feeling really good about the Limited format after my day one. And one of my goals was I want to 6-0 a Pro Tour draft section at some point. And I'm going to continue to just put a ton of effort into working on Limited. But man, these Pro Tour drafts are hard. And like the amount of work you have to put into being at the top of the Limited rankings is something that takes a lot of effort. So definitely still a goal of mine. And I'm going to just do as many drafts as possible before the Pro Tour in Seattle.
Yeah, it's tough when like, you know, constructed formats, you have a lot of time to practice. And even though things are shifting, like you can retain a lot of knowledge about the format over time. Whereas Limited, it's like a squeeze to try and learn everything so fast. And it's still evolving a lot of times when these Pro Tours roll around, the format's not fully settled even.
Yeah, totally. Tricky, but overall, I had a lot of fun. I really enjoyed this draft format.
Awesome. Well, the 6-0 will be coming down the road, I'm sure of it. But before we talk about Pioneer and Constructed at Pro Tour MKM, we want to let you know that the Bolt Zone is happy to be partnering with our friends over at Heavy Play. Heavy Play is a card gaming accessories brand built to improve your gameplay and game day experience with their lineup of high quality products. They feature enhanced ergonomics, mobility, and protection for your collection. And the big selling point for Heavy Play is their unique EquipMag system. Their deck boxes and play mats feature super strong magnets that let you attach everything together. You can carry it all in one hand, keep everything super steady on your playing surface. And this is really convenient both during play and between rounds to keep your stuff secure. I've been using Heavy Play's playmat and deck boxes a lot personally, and I'm really enjoying them. They feel super premium, very durable, which is something I appreciate on game day. And the new purple colorway that they just released is super vibrant. It's one of my favorite colors of any products that I've used recently, and I am really enjoying that as well. So if you want to check out some Heavy Play gear for yourself, you can ask about it at your LGS. You can check them out at upcoming conventions. They're going to be at PAX East in Boston from March 21 to March 24, and SCGCon Atlanta in April from the 12th to the 14th. So you can get your hands on the products, try them out for yourself, and pick up some there, or you can get on their website at heavyplay.com. You can use the promo code BTB10 at checkout. You'll get 10% off your entire first order and help support the show in the process. So again, check out the website, shop the full lineup there. Promo code BTB10 will get you 10% off your entire first order, and you help support the show. All right, Nathan, let's talk about some Pioneer. So the meta was pretty, I'd say for the most part, at least the top end, pretty expected. There was 18%, is it Phoenix, 14% Blue-White, 14% Rakdos, 8.9% Lotus, 6.6% Amalia in the top five spots. But we did have a newcomer, which we'll talk about in a minute. You played Is It Phoenix, though. So what was your thought behind selecting that deck, other than I know that you're a big fan of Phoenix?
For me, selecting Phoenix was more of a feeling of, I don't think Phoenix has really any bad matchups in the field after the way we built our deck. Like, I legitimately felt the worst matchup was something that we had put a lot of work into improving in Lotus Field, and I felt kind of confident playing against that with our build. And so I generally think that Phoenix is like sort of a Jund-esque deck, but also it just does something pretty fundamentally broken. Like, it was a deck that everyone tried to attack and it still had insanely high win percentage. It plays Treasure Cruise and it plays a ton of cantrips. It's just extremely consistent and Mulligans well. And so to me, Phoenix is just an example of a best deck that is the best deck for a very strong reason, which is it does something that other decks can't compete with if their deck doesn't do their thing. Like, if you're playing against Phoenix and your deck doesn't have a above average or average draw, you're just going to lose. It doesn't really matter what you're playing most of the time. Like, structurally, Phoenix is just so much more consistent than what other decks are doing. And so to me, it was just a feeling of our Phoenix deck has a huge edge in the mirror matches. And we also have a huge edge over the normal builds, at least against Lotus Field. And so that's why I'm going to play Phoenix. And for those who are unaware, I played two copies of Ashiok Dream Render in the main deck, which started off as a meme, but this was probably the biggest incentive for me to play the Phoenix deck before we figured out Ashiok in our testing house with Team Handshake. I was playing Lotus Field, which felt super comfortable with and thought was good, but I thought our Phoenix deck solved so many issues by adding Ashiok that it would be foolish not to play it at that point. So that's sort of the process that went into it, but the, you know, big part of what Ashiok does, just to sort of talk about this change really quickly, is Ashiok means when you're playing the mirror match that you essentially have like main deck Soul Guide Lanterns when you're playing against other Phoenixes. The way you play is you want to set up to play Ashiok with 1 to 2 removal spells up, and then they can try to kill your Ashiok, but you can kill the Phoenixes and then exile them. It's very hard to directly damage the Ashiok, and the plan with it is to mill your opponents because it's not actually that easy for them to have a lot of relevant cards left in deck. Like if you hit 1 or 2 of their Phoenixes, if you hit their Trespass, their Galvanic Iteration, even any of their threats like Halls or Letter Shredders, it's pretty quick that your opponent will just run out of relevant cards in their deck. So yeah, that was our strategy with the Ashiok, which is play it at a spell pierce range on turn 5 after the game is stabilized, exile their graveyard, and you usually just win. Like that's the game.
Yeah, I had such a big smile on my face when I opened your deck list and saw that in there. I was like, damn, this is spicy. sometimes the best deck innovations come out of a meme.
Yeah. And the funny part is at the time, the two other decks we were highest on were Lotus Field and Amalia, which Ashiok kind of hosed them both. And so we kind of were joking like, oh, we're just like trying to kill our own team decks. Like maybe this is bad, but it's good against what everyone on the team is playing. The reality of it was, I think it was a really good piece of tech that we recognized and I think really changed our matchup spread in matchups that were previously hard to gain an edge in. So super happy with that.
Yeah, definitely. So for Ashiok being included here, was this more of just like a choice for the PT meta that you anticipated specifically? Or, you know, do you think this is something that like Phoenix players should consider moving forward just in general?
I think that as long as Phoenix is the most popular deck, even playing one copy in your main deck gives you a huge edge and you probably should play one. The second copy is very flexible and you don't necessarily have to play it, I think. But to me, the trade-offs when you play Ashiok are you're worse against blue-white control and you're better into the mirror match and you're slightly worse against black-red mid-range slash vampires. But even in those matchups, you often have some ability to play more narrow cards because you have ways of looting. They have, you know, discard spells and you have Letter Shredders and stuff. And so I think that the cost of one Ashiok is low enough that you should probably play it in the main deck as long as Phoenix is the most popular deck. And especially if Lotus is popular, like normally Phoenix is like 30% against Lotus game one. I think with Ashiok, you're closer to like 40 to 45%. So adding 1 to 2 copies goes a long way.
Yeah. And it's just the like exiling the graveyard and milling them that is so impactful against Lotus, or it's the searching as well as shutting off the
search. It shuts off
everything, actually, I guess.
Yeah. Sylvan Scrying, Ultimatum, and basically the only live card in their deck is Pour Over the Pages and Odawara and Leer. And so if they don't have multiple pours or chain those together, they can't kill the Ashiok and they will just not be able to do anything. Like I was playing on the Lotus out a lot, and sometimes you just play Ashiok and the game's over. Also, Ashiok can mill them and try to hit 2 or 3 relevant combo like pieces, and that can end the game too.
Very nice. That's sweet tech. And I think, you know, you mentioned that it like makes you maybe a little bit worse into some of the other matchups, but I feel like those ones you can address with your sideboard a lot more effectively than some of these other ones.
Yeah, I mean, gaining an edge in game one of these matchups matters a lot. I think that there becomes more of a prisoner's dilemma as people add copies of like the cards in the main deck, where it's like, maybe prisoner's dilemma is not the right term I'm trying to think, but essentially like a game where if you have them, your opponent is kind of obligated to play their copies in the deck as well. And it might collectively be better if you all decided not to play it for the win rate of the deck. But since one person is going to play it, then you should play it as well, or else you're going to lose a huge edge, if that makes sense.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Any other like notable card choices that you want to point out about the deck build?
I kind of wish we had fit a second Spell Pierce somewhere in the deck list, but we didn't manage to make that happen. I think that Cryptic Coat was a card we overlooked that some people played to good effect and maybe could have been a nice sideboard card. We played two copies of Brazen Borrower, which against one of the most popular decks that we're going to talk about that a team showed up with was a huge kind of random piece of tech that ended up serving us really well over the tournament, but was really happy with the two Brazen Borrowers, whereas I think one was the stock number.
Well, let's talk about that. The cat's out of the bag. Rakdos Vampires showed up, and when Frank Karsten put his PT meta article out and we saw that it was 4.3%, everyone was pretty hyped to kind of see, you know, what innovation had come out and what this deck had turned into that convinced so many people to play it at the Pro Tour. And then we learned that, of course, it was the Team CFB deck. So did you have any intel on this going into the event, or was this like totally out of left field?
Up until Thursday of the event, I truthfully had no idea that this deck was a deck in the format. And so they definitely caught our team by surprise. I feel that we sort of whiffed on figuring out the interaction of Sorin and Vein Ripper, and that was pretty huge of them to do so. But no, I had no idea.
Yeah, I think you and everyone else, because it definitely kind of came out of nowhere and then totally took the tournament by storm with the high win rate and putting two copies in the top eight. Let's talk about this for just a minute. So with Sorin, Imperious Bloodlord for three mana, this lets you cheat out the new card Vein Ripper from MKM, which is a lot of people were comparing it to like an Archon of Cruelty for standard. It's just really hard to remove. It's going to let you win the damage race very quickly, lets you gain an edge with it with any removal that's happening. And this card coming out on turn three is just brutal. And then, you know, another important addition, I think, too, is Preacher of the Schism, which is also a newer card that just gives you a lot of value and works really well with, you know, a lot of the other things the deck wants to be doing. And that was a big addition as well, just to the Vampire's archetype. And then not to mention Cavern of Souls too, coming into the format recently, just being able to make the Vampires uncounterable has upped the whole archetype quite a bit.
Yeah, I think that they found a really nice innovation to the traditional Black and Midrange deck, which our team thought was pretty weak overall. And we thought that it would be a pretty poor choice, even though a lot of people chose to bring it. I think that it was the worst performing deck in terms of the big ones, except the Vampires deck, on the other hand, did great in the tournament, putting two in top eight and having a really solid overall win rate. So I think they figured something out. I'm a little skeptical that it's a great thing to do moving forward. Like, I do think it's sort of an exploitable deck. And by this, I mean that I think the traditional Rakdos Vampire shell is like reliant on the Sorin package to perform really well, because it plays some underpowered cards instead. And I see some innovations from like the Phoenix list, even playing cards like Tashana's Tidebinder post PT, which serve as a really strong answer to the Sorin package. So my current thinking right now is like, maybe not the deck you want to be playing going forward, but certainly something to keep an eye on for Pioneer. And like, congrats to CFB for a really impressive deck selection. And yeah, they did awesome.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to kind of see where it goes, but it definitely had its weekend and it did its job. So very cool. Let's talk about, I know that you've talked to Simon Nielsen quite a bit and you guys are close. His Boros Heroic deck that got him into the top eight. Did you talk to him at all before the event about that? And I know he was joking around saying that like he wanted to do well with a deck that had no good matchups, but any thoughts on like Heroic and how that all played out?
One thing about Simon is he is an absolute master at playing these scrappy white creature decks that need to assemble a lot of synergies in order to have a game plan that wins. And in testing, he was winning a lot with the Heroic deck, but no one could replicate his results particularly well. And one thing that I think speaks to this is just he was very, good at understanding what he needed to play towards and stealing a lot of games that me and some of the other teammates I had didn't believe that we could do in real time with the deck. And so I think that it might be a spot where it was the correct deck selection choice for Simon, but no one else, which is not how I normally feel about deck selection in Magic, but this was a unique circumstance where I think unless I committed a ton of resources to learning this deck, it would not have been a good choice. And even then, I don't know that it was excellent. I think it was just a fine choice that Simon was particularly great at playing.
Yeah, unsurprising there that Simon was excellent at playing a deck. But I think it does kind of serve as like a microcosm of Pioneer, which, you know, people are always saying, and we've said on the show before, learn your deck inside and out, know your matchups, and you can do well with whatever. And I think, you know, that's a cool example of, yeah, maybe this deck would not have done well for anyone else, but with his like mastery of it, he was able to perform well.
Really cool to see. But I also just want to shout out Simon for being like not only an amazing player on this insane run, you know, top eighting like four events in a row or something, he's also just a really great person, like super good friend, and I wish him all the success going forward. And I find like everyone who's watched the PT cover recently knows, but he's just like a really, really easy person to root for. Like he
totally, you know,
is so enthusiastic and expressive. And I would say that like really good guy overall, and just looking forward to him continually crushing.
Yeah, I couldn't say it better myself. All right. Any other thoughts on Pioneer, or like, we can actually talk about your run through Constructed if you want to, or anything from the Pro Tour.
I'll go through it really briefly. The main highlights of it were after my disappointing round three limited match against Logan Nettles, no lunch break, just sort of feeling exhausted. This is a funny anecdote. I played against a Boros Convoke player who didn't speak any English. He spoke Chinese. Oh, and in the match, he was playing a triple sleeved Boros Convoke deck against my Phoenix deck. And I was just laughing. I didn't even know how else to process this. But whenever he played a flip land, he would take it out of the entire triple sleeve and then flip it over. Instead of having like a flip card to go on top of it or whatever,
yeah,
he would take it out of the triple sleeve and flip it over all the way and take like a minute turning it to the other side. And I'd never seen this before, but this guy, he played like seven flip lands over the course of our three games. Like, and every time it must have been on the wrong side for what he wanted to play it on or something. Because I swear, like 10 minutes or something of my life was taken watching him like flip the land.
That's crazy.
Normally when you do that, you would say like, okay, I played on this color, I cast my spell, it's your turn or whatever. Right. But he didn't speak English and there was some like language barriers there. And so I think he didn't want a shortcut or kind of have some sort of communication issue. And so he just took his time flipping his land and doing that. And the hardest part was, you know, a judge is watching the whole time. And I'm like, judge, like, hello? Like,
yeah.
But he didn't speak any Chinese either. And he just seems sort of ambivalent at this point and just like, eh, like, I feel like this is wrong, but like, I don't even know how to step in this case. And so he doesn't do anything. And I lose that match in like a pretty close game three, but that was like a funny highlight of the first round of Constructed. I'm just internally screaming like, what is going on right now? Like, I can't believe this is real.
That's wild. He had no other choice. He had to play Convoke because no other deck would give him the time to flip his cards.
We went to time. We were negative 10 minutes and we had like a slight time extension. But man, that round going to time and me losing and just feeling like, oh my gosh, like these last two matches have been like brutal. I got to fight back. Was a tough moment to fight back from. And then I had some really tight matches against highlights where like I played against my buddy Calc, Christian Calcano, and I beat him in Red Black Midrange. A very close match overall. And then the last round I won against Blue White Control. And this was probably like my best played match of the tournament, but I'll spare the details other than I won game two when he had seven cards to my one card in hand by like him making a slight mistake on like turn 15 where he cast a farewell and then he died to my Hall of the Storm Giants when I think he could have won if he didn't mess up in that sequence somewhere. But this really complicated sequence where I like Galvanic Iteration of Brazen Borrower to bounce his Narset to Cantrip and bounce a Yore out of his and get back in the game just very slightly. So pretty cool.
Those lines always feel so good.
And then I win game three with like 3 minutes left on the clock and rushing through everything, win game three. So that was to end the day 6-2, and I felt great after that. And then,
yeah, that's impressive to be able to bounce back, rattle off four straight wins after those two rounds that kind of take it out of you.
Yeah, just beat after day one of the event, and day two, the roller coaster, 0-3, start the draft, 3-0, start constructed, feeling really good, 0-2, lose to Yuta Takahashi and Reed in some really good matches, and you know, I finished 9-7, a little bit less than 10-6, which would be like, okay, pretty respectable finish. 9-7 for me is just like, not my best result, but I'll take it for what it is. And so ultimately that just means for the next Pro Tour, I need to make day two and then I'll qualify for Amsterdam. So high pressure event, but haven't missed day two in quite a while and feeling good as long as I put in the real time to prep. And yeah, I'm looking forward to the event in Seattle.
Yeah, no prop. Day two, you'll get it. All right, cool. So any other thoughts on the Pro Tour, on Pioneer, anything that's coming up for you?
Last thing I'll say about not the Pro Tour or Pioneer, but there is a SCG this weekend I'm going to be playing, and it's Modern. So I'm excited to play three tournaments, maybe two, with my four-color Rhinos deck. And I haven't played it much, the Domain Rhinos deck, but it's going to get banned on Monday is my prediction. So,
oh, yeah. It's sweet, though. Forward.
It's last little hurrah.
Yeah, it's super sweet. I remember like when everyone decided to bring it last minute at Denver and then it like did really well. I was so mad that I didn't make the switch and pick it up because I played a little bit with it after and it's super fun. So I'm excited to hear how the event goes.
Yeah. No, it seems super sweet, but really, really excited about that. And I haven't played one of these SCG events in a while, but they're always a blast.
Yeah, that'll be cool. Are you planning to do anything over in Philly while you're there?
Go into the Valley Forge Casino. Maybe I'll have some fun and gamble just a little bit, although we'll see what happens. And otherwise, yeah, just excited to play Modern, which I haven't had any tournaments for in quite a while.
That'll be cool. Modern is... Cascade world right now, but I agree with you that I think on Monday we'll see some different things.
Yeah.
Awesome, man. Well, it was great to have you back and great to hear about your card, Duelist of the Mind. Great to hear about everything from Pro Tour MKM. But I think that's going to do it for today's episode of The Bold Zone. So if you enjoy the show, please give us a follow, leave a review on the podcast platform of your choice. We read all of them. We love hearing from you guys. You can get in touch with us on Twitter using the hashtag Bold Zone Chat. Let us know what you think about the episode. Show us the merch you pick up. And if you want to help support the show, you can subscribe to the Patreon. Link for that's going to be in the show notes. And you can also check out our new merch over at boltthebirdmtg.com/shop. Or you can work with one of our partners over at Heavy Play or TOA Magic using the codes that we'll also put in the show notes. Get some great discounts on their products and help support us in the process. But until next time, that's going to do it. So get out there, sling some spells.